Usually when we talk about medical diagnosis, there is this immense, almost unspoken expectation of precision.
Oh, absolutely. We expect total clarity.
Right. It feels like engineering, you know? Think about the last time you broke a bone. You go to the clinic, they take an X-ray, and a few minutes later, the doctor puts it up on the screen, and there's that stark, jagged white line across the radius.
You can see exactly what's wrong.
Exactly. The doctor points to it with the pen, and there is an incredible sense of relief, even in all that pain, because there it is. The problem is visible, it's local, it's binary.
It's entirely unambiguous. I mean, broken or not broken. And that clarity provides a tremendous psychological comfort because, you know, human beings fundamentally crave a world that can be
Yeah,
categorized.
we want the boxes.
We desperately want to believe that our bodies operate on a simple linear logic. The idea that a specific broken part can be isolated and a simple mechanical fix, like a plaster cast or a few screws, will just put everything back to exactly the way it was.
We basically want to be cars in a mechanic shop.
Yeah.
The alternator is busted, so you swap it out for a new one and you drive away.
Right.
But the reality is, and we all know this deep down, the vast majority of human suffering doesn't look like a clean break on an X-ray.
Not at all.
You step into the world of chronic illness, or autoimmune conditions, or neurodevelopment, or honestly, just the day-to-day creeping reality of feeling exhausted, brain-fogged, and stressed out. You go to the doctor with those symptoms, they run a blood panel, and everything comes back, quote unquote, in the normal range.
Which is the most frustrating thing a patient can hear.
It's maddening.
Yeah.
Suddenly, that satisfying X-ray machine metaphor is completely useless.
Yeah.
We find ourselves looking at a diagnostic landscape that is entirely
It
murky.
is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. And the reason it feels so frustrating, both for the patient seeking answers and, frankly, the physician trying to provide them, is that the mechanical, machine-like metaphors we rely on to understand biology just completely fall apart when they're faced with complex systemic issues. A car engine doesn't decide to get inflamed because it had a stressful argument with another car, you know? But a human body does.
Which is exactly why we are here today. Welcome in, everyone. Today is Monday, May 4, 2026, and we are going to wade right into those muddy
We
waters.
really are.
We are going to ask a question that has the potential to completely shatter and rebuild how you view every single ache, pain, emotional shift, and physiological response your body experiences. And the question is this: what if everything we have been taught about how our bodies work, this deeply ingrained, almost invisible assumption that we are just biological machines breaking down and requiring external instruction to be fixed, what if that is fundamentally backward?
It is an incredibly ambitious question.
It really is.
And to answer it, we are working with a piece of source material today that is genuinely paradigm shifting. I mean, it requires a complete rewiring of our vocabulary.
We are looking at a brand new, highly detailed academic white paper published just today by Dr. Bechara Sahili. It is titled From Autopoiesis to Living Coherence. For those of you joining us, this paper is a bold, highly technical attempt to take the theoretical biology of Humberto Maturana, who was a brilliant Chilean philosopher and neurobiologist, and merge his concepts with cutting-edge modern medical science.
The ambition of Dr. Sahili's paper really cannot be overstated. He is not merely presenting, you know, a new data set on a specific disease. He is proposing an entirely new biological grammar.
All new language.
Exactly. He takes Maturana's deeply philosophical concepts about the very definition of what it means to be, quote, alive, and rigorously applies them to the tangible clinical realities of cellular biology, immunology, and how we actually develop chronic diseases.
So our mission on this deep dive is to equip you with that new grammar. We want to give you, the naturally curious learner, a completely new lens for understanding your own health and your own illnesses. We are going to actively try to move you away from a vocabulary centered on control and repair and introduce you to a vocabulary built around coherence and coupling.
It's a huge shift.
It is. My promise to you is that by the end of this hour, the way you think about swallowing a pill, changing your diet, or even just sitting in traffic feeling your blood pressure rise is going to be completely reframed.
We are dismantling the machine. We are taking that car metaphor, throwing it out entirely, and replacing it with something far more dynamic, far more beautiful, and infinitely more accurate to the actual lived experience of being a biological organism.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to dismantle the machine, we have to start at the very foundation of Dr. Sahili's paper, which leans heavily into Maturana's work. The first massive, somewhat intimidating word we hit in the text is Autopoiesis.
Yes, autopoiesis.
If this is the central premise of the whole new biological grammar, how do we actually define it? What does it mean for the listener sitting at home?
Well, if we break the word down into its Greek roots, auto means self, and poiesis means creation or production.
Like poetry?
Exactly. It's the exact same root we use for the word poetry. So autopoiesis is self-creation. In this framework, it is the singular defining characteristic of a living system. A living organism continuously produces the very components that make it up. It is entirely autonomous in its self-production.
Let me try to visualize this. If we go back to the car is what the text would call an allopoietic machine, right?
Yes, allo meaning other.
Right.
An allopoietic machine is produced by something other than itself. A car is assembled in a factory by robots and human hands. Once it rolls off the line, it is finished. It just sits there.
It doesn't generate its own spark plugs.
Exactly. It doesn't weave its own seat belts. It merely degrades over time due to friction in the elements until an external agent, a mechanic, comes in, removes a broken piece, and installs a new one.
But a living cell operates on a completely different plane of reality. If a cell were a car, it would be driving down the highway at 70 miles an hour while simultaneously melting down its own engine block, forging new pistons, synthesizing new fuel, and rebuilding its own chassis second by second without ever stopping or relying on a mechanic.
That is a phenomenal way to picture it. A living cell is a bustling microscopic city that is constantly consuming itself and rebuilding itself.
Wow.
Proteins are synthesized, degraded, and recycled. Membranes are torn down and rebuilt. And the cell does this entirely on its own, based on its own internal rules. Because it produces itself, it is autonomous. And this autonomy leads directly to the most counterintuitive yet most crucial concept in Maturana's grammar, structural determination.
Structural determination. This is where the paper starts severely challenging our normal thought process. The text contrasts structural determination with external instruction. Walk us through the difference there.
Well, if a living system is an autonomous, self-producing entity, it can only change according to its own internal structure. It cannot be instructed by the environment.
Wait, really?
Yes. Think about how radical that is. The environment cannot dictate to the organism what to do. The environment can only provide a perturbation, a disturbance, or a trigger. How the organism responds to that trigger is determined 100% by the organism's internal structure at that specific microsecond in time.
Okay, I really need to ground this in an analogy.
Yeah.
If we look at the old paradigm, the machine paradigm we were trying to leave behind,
yeah,
it's perfectly represented by the thermostat on my living room wall.
Sure.
The thermostat is an instructed system. If the temperature in the room drops to 65 degrees, the environment provides the input, and the thermostat is instructed by its programming to react in one specific way. It turns on the furnace. The environment dictated the outcome.
That is a linear, instructed relationship. The input equals the output.
But under structural determination, I am not a thermostat. I have something vastly more complex, like an old-growth forest.
I like that.
If a massive Category 5 hurricane hits that forest, that hurricane is the perturbation. But the hurricane does not instruct the forest on how to react. It doesn't hand the forest a blueprint. The way the forest responds depends entirely on its own historical, complex internal state.
Exactly.
Are the tree roots deep because there was a drought 10 years ago? Is the soil loose from a recent thaw? Are the underground fungal networks robust? The exact same hurricane could cause one forest to bend and flourish with the new rainfall while causing a neighboring forest to suffer a catastrophic ecosystem-destroying landslide. The storm triggered the event, but the structure of the forest determined the outcome.
The history and the structure of the system determine the outcome, not the trigger itself. The perturbation merely reveals the current structural reality of the organism.
Hold on. I am struggling to map this onto everyday reality, specifically when we talk about injury or illness. Let me play devil's advocate here.
Please do.
Let's say I am walking down the street, minding my own business, and a city bus jumps the curb and hits me, breaking my leg and leaving a massive bruise. Or, you know, I go to a crowded indoor concert and inhale a highly contagious strain of influenza. The bus broke my leg. The virus made me violently ill. That feels like pure, undeniable external instruction. The environment forced an outcome on me.
It is the most natural objection to this framework, and it really highlights why the nuance here is so vital. It sounds like semantics, but the distinction changes everything about how we view medicine. Let us look at the bus.
Okay.
The bus absolutely hits you. The bus transfers an immense amount of kinetic energy into your tissue. That is a severe, potentially lethal perturbation. But the bus does not know how to make a bruise.
Wait, the bus doesn't make the bruise.
Not at all. The kinetic energy ruptures your cells, but the actual phenomenon of a bruise, the cascade of events that follows, is entirely a product of your biological grammar.
Oh, wait.
When those cells rupture, your body releases chemical messengers like histamine. Those messengers cause your local capillaries to dilate and become permeable. Blood pools into the tissue. Macrophages, your immune cleanup cells, they migrate to the area to consume the dead cellular debris, eventually turning that pooled blood from red to purple to green to yellow. That entire highly orchestrated symphony of inflammation and repair is your body's structurally determined response.
So I made the bruise.
We made the bruise, not the bus. The bus merely provided the constraint to which your autopoiesis had to adapt.
That is a staggering shift of perspective. So the virus doesn't know how to create a fever either.
Right.
The virus just enters my respiratory tract and begins replicating. My body detects the viral proteins. My immune cells release cytokines. Those cytokines travel to the hypothalamus in my brain, and my brain physically resets my core temperature to 102 degrees to bake the virus out. My body creates the fever as an autonomous response.
The organism always dictates the response. You cannot command a living system from the outside. You can only perturb it, constrain it, or support it. Think about what this means for pharmaceuticals.
How so?
Well, when a doctor prescribes an antibiotic, that pill does not magically cure the infection in a vacuum. The antibiotic perturbs the bacterial cells, ideally to the point of their destruction, but it relies entirely on your body's autopoiesis to clear the bacterial debris, reduce the fever, rebuild the damaged tissue in your throat or lungs, and restore your baseline health. Without your self-producing structure doing the work, the drug is useless.
So for you listening, apply this to the choices you make every day. When you decide to adopt a drastic new diet to lose weight, or you start taking a medication to lower your cholesterol, you are not typing new code into a computer. You are not reprogramming your hardware. You are simply introducing a new perturbation. You are changing the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And you are crossing your fingers, trusting that your body's autopoietic structure is in a state where it will respond to that new diet by building lean muscle and burning fat, rather than responding to it as a starvation threat that spikes your stress hormones.
Exactly. If your internal structure is currently locked in a state of chronic stress, your body will perceive that aggressive new diet as just another threat. It will downregulate your metabolism and hold on to fat to survive. Because, to reiterate the core rule, you cannot force a living system into a specific outcome. You can only alter the conditions under which it produces itself.
We are not machines awaiting commands. We are autonomous unities in a constant dialogue with the world. But this brings us to a massive logistical hurdle in Dr. Sahizi's paper.
Okay.
If we aren't a machine with a central computer chip telling all the parts what to do, how do the trillions of distinct autonomous cells in the human body actually coordinate? How does my liver know what my brain is doing? Why doesn't this entire system just dissolve into microscopic anarchy?
It is the defining question of multicellular life. If autopoiesis explains the single cell, Dr. Sahizi introduces a synthetic concept to explain the whole human being, which is living coherence. He defines this as the dynamic congruence among nested biological, relational, and ecological processes that keep an organism viable.
I want to dig into that phrase, nested closures.
Oh.
It is used throughout the paper. At first glance, I picture those wooden Russian nesting dolls, the Matryoshka dolls, a small cell inside a larger organ inside a larger body. But that feels too static.
The nesting doll metaphor captures the layers, but it totally misses the action.
Right.
A better way to visualize nested closures is to imagine a sprawling, hyper-complex city. You have the sanitation department, the electrical grid, the transit system, and the economy. The transit system doesn't just sit inside the city. Its movement allows the workers to reach the power plant, which keeps the electrical grid running, which powers the computers that manage the economy, which generates the taxes that fund the sanitation department.
Oh, I see.
The processes are closed loops, but they feed into one another. If the transit system halts, the electrical grid eventually fails. Their viability is deeply mutually entwined.
So living coherence isn't just about having all the parts. It is about the constant rhythmic interaction of those parts. It is dynamic.
The word dynamic is essential. We often use the word homeostasis to describe biological balance, but homeostasis can conjure an image of a still pond. A static equilibrium.
Yeah, just sitting there.
Living coherence is closer to a tightrope walker or a surfer. The surfer is balanced on the board, but that balance is achieved through constant micro adjustments of their knees, their weight distribution, and their core tension, all in response to a wave that is continuously changing shape beneath them. Coherence is an active, ongoing achievement.
To really understand how this works, the paper zooms all the way down to the microscopic level. It looks at the very engines of this coherence, starting with something everyone remembers from high school biology class, the mitochondria. We all learned the phrase, the mitochondria are the powerhouses of the cell. They make ATP, the energy currency.
Yeah.
But Dr. Sekely pulls from a field called mitochondrial psychobiology to show that this powerhouse label is a massive, almost insulting oversimplification.
It reduces a wildly complex participant to a dumb furnace. In this new grammar, mitochondria are not just blind engines shoveling coal. They are incredibly sensitive environmental sensors, resource managers, and communication hubs.
So they do way more than make energy.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, they manage bioenergetics, but they also regulate the cellular stress response. They modulate how the immune system behaves. They buffer internal calcium levels. They even control cell fate. The decision of whether a cell should repair itself, divide, or undergo apoptosis, which is programmed cell death.
But they aren't the boss of the cell either, right? Because if we say the mitochondria are giving the orders, we're just slipping back into the machine metaphor.
Correct. They are participants in a democratic self-producing network. When the larger organism experiences a perturbation, say a sudden drop in blood sugar or a massive spike in cortisol because you just narrowly avoided a car accident, that macro level event changes the chemical environment of the cell. The mitochondria sense this change immediately.
And what do?
They physically alter themselves. They undergo fission, splitting into smaller pieces to maximize energy output, or fusion, joining together to share resources. And as they do this, they release signals to tell the rest of the cell how to adapt.
And the mechanism they use to send those signals completely blew my mind because it involves something that the wellness industry has spent the last 30 years demonizing ROS, or reactive oxygen species, free radicals.
The reframing of reactive oxygen species in this paper is profound. The mainstream narrative for decades has been incredibly militaristic. Free radicals are the bad guys.
Always.
They are toxic exhaust fumes from metabolism. They cause oxidative stress, they damage your DNA, they cause aging, and you must constantly consume berries and green tea antioxidants to hunt them down and neutralize them.
It is entirely pitched as a battle between the heroic antioxidants and the evil oxidative stress.
But modern redox biology reveals that this is a fundamentally incomplete picture. Reactive oxygen species are not merely toxic waste. They are an ancient, elegant, and vital cellular language. When mitochondria process oxygen to make energy, a tiny fraction of electrons slip out of the chain and bind with oxygen to create these highly reactive molecules. Because they are missing an electron, they desperately seek to bind with other proteins.
Which sounds bad. That sounds like damage.
It can cause damage if unregulated, but in healthy biology, that reactivity is a feature, not a bug. Yes. When ROS binds to a specific cellular protein, it oxidizes it. That oxidation changes the physical shape of a protein. And in biology, shape dictates function. By changing the shape of proteins, ROS acts as a signaling mechanism. It travels to the nucleus of the cell and literally alters gene expression. It is the messenger that tells the DNA, we are under stress. We need to adapt.
Let me trace the biology here to make sure I'm following. I decide to go for a brutal high-intensity run. I am pushing my body to the limit. My muscles are burning. My cells are experiencing massive energetic demand. My mitochondria ramp up ATP production. And in doing so, they pump out a huge amount of ROS.
Yes.
Under the old narrative, I have just flooded my system with toxic poison. But under the living coherence model, that ROS is shouting a crucial message. It is saying the environment demands more from us. And that specific ROS signal is what travels to the nucleus, triggers the genes, and causes the cell to build more mitochondria and become stronger for the next run.
That is the essence of adaptation. If you were to take a massive artificial dose of synthetic antioxidants immediately after that run, you would chemically neutralize all of that ROS. You would effectively put a gag order on your mitochondria.
Wow.
You silence the cellular language of adaptation, and you completely blunt the training effect of the workout. The oxidative stress only becomes a pathology when it loses its proportion, when the signal never turns off, or when the cell lacks the basic structural capacity to respond and return to coherence.
Here's where it gets really interesting. this scales up so perfectly. Dr. Stanley doesn't just leave this as a neat trick of cellular biology. He connects the microscopic chatter of mitochondria and redox signaling directly to how we experience psychological stress in our daily lives using the concept of allostatic load. Can you walk us through the actual biological mechanism of how a subjective experience like feeling stressed out at work translates into this cellular reality?
To understand allostatic load, we first have to understand allostasis. As we discussed, homeostasis is maintaining stability. Allostasis is maintaining stability through change. It is the organism's ability to anticipate demands and adjust its entire biological set point to meet those demands.
Okay.
Let's trace the pathway. You're sitting at your desk and you receive an angry, threatening email from your boss. The perturbation begins as photons hitting your retina. Your optic nerve transmits that data to your visual cortex. The information is quickly routed to your amygdala, the brain's threat detection center. Based on your structural history, perhaps past experiences of financial insecurity or workplace trauma, your amygdala interprets this email as a severe threat to your survival.
So the brain literally reads the email as a predator.
Biologically, there is very little distinction.
That's a while.
The amygdala sends a distress signal to the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus releases a hormone called CRH, which travels to the pituitary gland. The pituitary releases ACTH into your bloodstream. When ACTH hits your adrenal glands, sitting on top of your kidneys, they pump out adrenaline and cortisol.
It's just a cascade of chemicals.
In a matter of seconds, your heart rate spikes to pump more blood. Your liver dumps stored glucose into your bloodstream so your muscles have instant fuel to run or fight. Your immune system mobilizes inflammatory cytokines, anticipating physical tissue damage. Your mitochondria are working in overdrive, generating huge amounts of ROS to signal this metabolic emergency. This massive system-wide orchestration is allostasis. It is a brilliant, highly coordinated structural coupling to a perceived threat.
It is an evolutionary masterpiece. It keeps you alive when you need to sprint away from danger.
Oh.
But here is the catch. You aren't sprinting away from a predator. You are sitting completely still in an ergonomic desk chair, staring at a screen.
Right.
And what happens when that angry email is just Tuesday morning? What happens when you are in a toxic work environment or an abusive relationship or facing systemic financial poverty and this exact pathway is triggered multiple times a day for 5 consecutive years?
The system gets locked in the on position. The constant demand forces the body to continuously adjust its set points. Your baseline blood pressure stays elevated. Your baseline blood sugar stays high. Your immune system remains constantly bathed in inflammatory signals. And the sheer energetic cost of maintaining this state of high alert is astronomical.
So you're basically burning through your reserves.
Exactly. This accumulated cost is what we call allostatic load. It is the physiological wear and tear of surviving under continuous strain. Over time, the constant flood of cortisol downregulates the receptors on your immune cells, meaning your immune system stops listening to the turnoff signal. The mitochondria, constantly forced to overproduce, become dysfunctional.
And the ROS?
The ROS signaling crosses the line from an adaptive whisper to a destructive, deafening scream of oxidative stress. The nested closures of your living coherence literally begin to fray because the energetic tax of maintaining this specific relationship with a hostile environment is bankrupting the organism.
This fundamentally changes how I view burnout. It is not a psychological failing. It is not that you just need a weekend off to recharge your battery. Your battery isn't empty. Your entire metabolic and cellular architecture has been structurally warped by the exorbitant cost of surviving your daily life. You have accumulated a crushing allostatic load.
And managing that load requires us to look beyond just the internal cells. We have to look at how the organism interacts with the outside world. Where does the self end and the environment begin?
Which is the perfect transition into section 3 of the paper. Redefining the borders of the self. We have to talk about the immune system. If any biological discipline has suffered from the limitations of the machine metaphor, it is classical immunology. Most of us are raised on a cartoonish, militaristic view of our immune system. We picture it as an army of white blood cells patrolling the fortress walls, and its singular, defining purpose is to seek out and destroy non-self invaders.
The us versus them paradigm. It views the body as a sterile fortress that must be defended at all costs. And Dr. Saheli, citing the groundbreaking work of immunologists like Nelson Vaz and Francisco Varela, argues that this militaristic view is deeply, dangerously incomplete.
How so?
Yes, defending against lethal pathogens is a crucial activity, but it is not the defining purpose of the immune network. Vaz and Varela proposed a radical shift. They argued that the immune system is fundamentally a cognitive network. Its primary job is what the paper calls relational identity conservation.
Relational identity conservation. So if we drop the army metaphor, what is a better way to think of the immune system? Is it a diplomatic corps? A border control agency combined with an urban planning department?
It is the biological interface that allows you to exist in a chaotic, microbe-filled world without dissolving into it. It is the organ of relationship. It navigates a staggering array of daily interactions that have nothing to do with war. It digests and integrates food. It manages the cleanup of dead cells. It coordinates tissue repair. It accommodates the profound biological paradox of pregnancy, where the body must tolerate a growing entity that contains foreign DNA.
The paper includes a fascinating breakdown of immune functions that expand way beyond just defense. Let's look at the first one, tolerance. In a militaristic framework, tolerance sounds like failure. It sounds like the fortress guards fell asleep. But this text frames tolerance as an active, energy-intensive core function.
Think about it. If your immune system actually behaved the way the military metaphor suggests, if it attacked every single non-self protein it encountered, you would be dead within hours.
All because of food.
Exactly. Every time you take a bite of an apple, you are introducing millions of foreign, non-self proteins into your digestive tract. The immune system lining your gut has to actively examine those apple proteins, assess them, and make a highly sophisticated decision to tolerate them. It has to say, this is not me, but it is safe, and we will integrate it. Tolerance is not weakness. It is the fundamental biological condition of coexistence.
And what about repair? We touched on this with the bruise analogy, but we generally view the immune system as the cause of our suffering when we are injured. It causes the swelling, the redness, the pain of inflammation. We take NSAIDs like ibuprofen to shut the immune system down.
Because we view inflammation purely as an attack, but inflammation is actually a highly orchestrated signaling cascade that initiates repair. When tissue is damaged, the inflammatory cytokines essentially yell, tear down the damaged architecture, bring in the raw materials, recruit the stem cells.
So it's a construction site, not a battlefield.
Inflammation is the necessary demolition phase before the reconstruction phase of relational identity conservation. When we chronically suppress it, we often suppress the healing itself.
Then there is immunological memory. We are familiar with this from the concept of vaccines, but framing it as identity conservation gives it a much deeper resonance.
The immune system literally embodies its history. It physically reshapes its own cellular makeup, creating memory T cells and B cells so that it can navigate future interactions with a specific perturbation more efficiently. It learns. And it relies on regulation and boundary maintenance to ensure these responses are proportionate.
And what happens when that regulation breaks down?
When these regulatory functions fail, you don't just get infections. You get conditions where the identity and relation becomes confused. You get allergies, where the system mounts a massive defense against harmless pollen. Or you get autoimmunity, where the system loses the ability to distinguish its own healthy thyroid or joint tissue from a threat and begins attacking itself. The coherence of the identity is lost.
And there is absolutely nothing that blurs the boundary of that identity more than the next major topic in this section, the microbiome. Dr. Samley introduces the concept of the organism-microbe niche unity. This is the realization that the idea of a purely human individual is essentially a biological fiction.
We are holobionts.
Holobionts, yes.
A holobiont is an assemblage of a host and all the symbiotic species living in or around it, functioning as a distinct ecological unit. We are historically constituted unities made of trillions of human cells and tens of taurians of microbial cells, bacteria, fungi, viruses. They outnumber our human cells.
It's crazy to think about.
The microbiome is not just a collection of microscopic hitchhikers residing in our gut. It is an active, indispensable organ of our living coherence. The microbiome physically educates the immune system on what to tolerate and what to attack. It breaks down complex carbohydrates we cannot digest, producing short-chain fatty acids that fuel our gut lining. It heavily regulates our metabolism.
And it regulates our brains. That is the part that is so hard to fathom. The microbes in our gut produce a massive percentage of our neurotransmitters, like serotonin and dopamine. Those chemicals travel up the vagus nerve to directly influence our mood, our anxiety levels, and our cognition. Our subjectivity is shaped by bacteria.
It entirely shatters the illusion of the isolated self, but this brings up a crucial clinical point.
Right. Let me bring this back to the listener's daily reality. Let's say I have chronic digestive issues. I go to a functional medicine doctor, they do a stool test, and they tell me I have dysbiosis, an overgrowth of bad bacteria in my gut, like an excess of candida or a specific pathogenic strain. Under the old militaristic model, I view this as an invasion. My fortress has been breached. The solution is to drop an antibiotic bomb, eradicate the bad guys, and maybe take a probiotic to parachute in some good guys.
That's the standard response, yeah.
But under the organism microbe niche unity model, those bad bacteria aren't an invading army. They are a symptom of a disrupted relationship, right?
That is the exact paradigm shift. Dysbiosis is reframed not as a simple infection, but as a disturbed pattern of structural coupling between the host, the microbes, and the environment.
So they were already there.
In most cases, yes, those bad bacteria were already there, living quietly in small numbers. They are opportunistic. They only overgrow because the environment of your gut, the terrain, has fundamentally changed in a way that favors their proliferation over the beneficial strains.
Like weeds taking over a garden because the soil pH changed. Why did the terrain change?
It could be myriad perturbations. Perhaps chronic psychological stress dumped cortisol into your system, which physically altered the motility of your digestive tract, creating stagnant areas where bacteria ferment.
Whoa.
Perhaps chronic sleep deprivation disrupted your circadian rhythms and your gut microbes, which also operate on a biological clock, fell out of sync. Perhaps a diet devoid of fibric plants starved the beneficial microbes, causing the mucosal lining of your gut to thin, triggering low-grade immune inflammation. The dysbiosis is an emergent property of a system that has lost its living coherence.
Which means healing it is wildly more complex than just taking a pill.
You cannot just micromanage the bacterial census with antibiotics and probiotics and expect long-term success if the terrain remains hostile. Healing requires addressing the entire unity. It requires changing the structural coupling. You might need to change the diet to feed the right microbes. You might need to enforce strict sleep hygiene. You might need to engage in trauma therapy or find relational safety to lower the chronic sympathetic nervous system drive that is halting your digestion. You are restoring the conditions for coherence, allowing a healthy microbial ecosystem to organically become viable again.
It is incredibly humbling. The boundary between me and my environment is porous. My immune system is constantly shaking hands with the outside world. My gut is filled with non-human DNA that dictates my mood. We are inextricably woven into our niche. But Dr. Sheely's paper pushes this even further. It blurs the line not just between our physical body and our physical environment, but between our deep biology and our subjective emotional experiences. This brings us to section 4 of the paper, the biology of experience.
This is where Mascherano's framework becomes truly radical, especially for modern medicine, which historically separates the mind and the body. Mascherano introduces the concept of emotioning.
I love that he uses it as a verb, emotioning. In this framework, emotions are not just fleeting, subjective psychological states happening in a vacuum. They aren't ghosts in the machine.
Not at all. Dr. Sicarelli explicitly integrates Mascherano's philosophy with the hard science of effective neuroscientists like Jack Panksepp and Antonio Damasio. Emotions are biologically grounded, evolutionary adaptations. They are intensely physical. The defining phrase Mascherano uses is that emotions configure the organism's domain of possible action.
Let's really drill down to that phrase, configure the domain of possible action. What does that actually look like in human physiology?
It means that an emotion literally biochemically changes what your body is physically capable of doing and what your brain is capable of perceiving in a given moment. An emotion alters your interoception, your immune tone, your cardiovascular dynamics, and your neuroendocrine rhythms to optimize your body for a specific type of interaction with the world.
The paper gives some stark examples. It argues that the emotion of fear brings forth a world of threat. The emotion of love brings forth a world of coexistence. The emotion of play brings forth a world of safe possibility.
Let's trace the biology of fear. When you are in a state of acute fear, your body configures its domain of action strictly for survival. Your peripheral vision literally narrows to focus on the threat. Your heart rate variability drops. Blood is shunted away from your digestive organs and your prefrontal cortex and pushed into your major skeletal muscles.
Ready to run.
Exactly. Your immune system shifts aggressively toward a pro-inflammatory state, anticipating a physical wound. The world you inhabit in that moment, your physical reality, is a world composed entirely of threats and escape routes. You are biologically incapable of creative problem solving or deep empathy in that exact state because your biology has closed off those domains of action.
And conversely, if we look at a state of play or love, which Mascherano defines in a beautifully biological way as the domain where the other arises as legitimate in coexistence, your physiology is the polar opposite.
Completely different.
When you feel safe, loved, and playful, your vagal tone, the influence of the vagus nerve, increases. Your heart rate slows and it becomes highly variable, which is a sign of resilience. Your digestive system turns back on. Your immune system shifts away from acute inflammation and focuses on surveillance, cleanup, and tissue repair. Your cognitive aperture widens. You can think laterally. You can connect. Your body is structurally coupled to a world of safe possibility.
It opens up the world.
I want you, the listener, to really sit with this and apply it to your own life. Think about a time you felt deep, profound shame. Maybe a public humiliation or a deep personal failure. Notice how your physical capability changes. When you are carrying heavy shame, your posture physically collapses. Your shoulders round, your breathing becomes incredibly shallow, your eye contact drops. You literally attempt to occupy less physical space.
You're trying to disappear.
That is not just in your head. That emotional state of shame is sending a cascade of neuropeptides through your body that alters your fascial tension, suppresses your cellular immune response, and shifts your endocrine rhythm. You are biologically a different organism when you are steeped in shame than you are when you are experiencing profound joy.
That is a perfect articulation of it. The subjective experience is the biological reality.
I try to visualize emotioning, like putting on different pairs of virtual reality glasses, but they don't just change the color tint of the room. They actually change the physical layout of the room you can walk through.
I love that analogy.
If I put on the fear glasses, suddenly the room shrinks. Walls appear everywhere. There is only one exit, and my entire biological machinery prepares to sprint toward it. If I put on the curiosity glasses, the walls disappear. A bunch of interesting, complex objects appear on tables, and my biology configures itself to wander, touch things, and learn. The emotion dictates the physical reality of my interaction with the world.
And this brings us crashing back into the concept of allostatic load. What happens to a human being, a living, self-producing system that is forced by their circumstances to wear the fear glasses or the shame glasses for years on end?
It's devastating.
Think about the impact of structural inequality, systemic racism, chronic financial insecurity, or a deeply toxic relationship. The organism is constantly, relentlessly configuring its biology for a world of threat. The immune system is constantly skewed toward tissue-damaging inflammation. The endocrine system is constantly bathed in corrosive levels of cortisol. The domains of possible action that allow for health rest, deep cellular repair, meaningful connection, creativity, are systematically biologically shut down.
The psychological becomes the biological. The social environment directly, physically manipulates the autopoiesis of the cells. That is a terrifying realization because it shows how deeply vulnerable we are to our environments. But it is also incredibly empowering.
It gives us a path forward.
Right. It means that changing our social relations, finding a community, establishing psychological safety, setting boundaries, experiencing dignity, these aren't just nice ethical concepts. Finding safety is a biological intervention that is as powerful, if not more powerful, than any pharmaceutical drug.
Dignity, care, and safety are the fundamental biological conditions required for the expansion of viable action and the maintenance of living coherence. Without them, the biology degrades.
Okay, let's take a breath and synthesize where we are. We have established that we are autonomous, self-producing unities. We are not machines. We maintain our viability through these dynamic nested closures, starting from the mitochondria and redox signaling in our cells, moving up through the immune tolerance and the microbiome in our gut, all the way to how our emotions configure our capacity to act in our social world. We are constantly engaged in this intricate, beautiful dance to maintain living coherence.
A delicate dance.
But what happens when the music stops? What happens when we stumble? If disease isn't just a broken machine part, what exactly is happening when we get sick? This brings us to what I consider the absolute climax of Dr. Sahili's paper, Section 5, The Six Stages of Unraveling.
This is where the framework offers a truly revolutionary redefinition of pathology.
Normally in the machine model, we define disease as a defect, a lesion, a genetic error, a clogged pipe, a faulty gear. But Dr. Sahili defines chronic disease as a costly, conserved pattern of living.
A costly conserved pattern of living. In this view, many of the chronic diseases plaguing the modern world, hypertension, type 2 diabetes, autoimmune disorders, chronic fatigue, severe depression, are not simply the random breakdown of a fragile organism.
So what are they?
They are actually the result of the organism trying desperately and brilliantly to survive. The organism adopts short-term survival mechanisms to maintain its autopoiesis in a hostile, demanding, or mismatched environment. But over time, because the environment doesn't change, these compensatory mechanisms become locked in. They become self-reinforcing, energetically expensive, and ultimately completely incongruent with the health of the whole organism.
The short-term fix becomes the long-term poison.
Mm.
And the body refuses to let go of the poison because it thinks it's the only thing keeping it alive.
Precisely. The body gets trapped in a survival loop. And the paper lays out a very specific, deep structure for how this happens, a six-stage grammar of disease.
I want to spend significant time here. We are going to walk through these exact six stages slowly, because honestly, reading this section was a massive aha moment for me. It maps onto almost every chronic health journey I've ever heard.
It's very clarifying.
To really ground this, let's build a hypothetical, highly relatable case study. Let's call her Sarah. Sarah is 40 years old. She's a corporate lawyer. She works 70 hours a week in a high-stakes adversarial environment. She sleeps 5 hours a night, relies on 4 cups of coffee to get through the day, eats highly processed takeout at her desk, and is dealing with the unresolved grief of a recent divorce.
A very common modern scenario.
Sadly, yes. That is the niche Sarah's organism is trying to couple with. So stage one is perturbation.
Stage one, perturbation.
Yeah.
A disturbance arises that severely challenges the viability of the organism. In Sarah's case, it is a massive, multifaceted onslaught. Her system is being bombarded by the psychosocial stress of litigation, the emotional trauma of the divorce, the circadian disruption of sleep loss, and the nutritional deficit of processed food. Her living coherence is deeply threatened.
So Sarah's body has to react to stay alive. This brings us to stage two, compensation.
In stage two, the organism shifts its structure to conserve its viability in the face of this onslaught. Sarah's body does exactly what it evolved to do. Because of the constant stress and sleep loss, her HPA axis shifts. Her cortisol levels remain chronically elevated to keep her awake and hyper alert. Her liver constantly mobilizes glucose into her bloodstream because her brain perceives a never-ending state of emergency.
And her immune system.
Her immune system, reacting to the stress hormones and the lack of gut-friendly fiber in her diet, shifts into a state of low-grade systemic inflammation. Her mitochondria alter their dynamics, undergoing constant fission to handle the frantic, inefficient energy demand, pumping out ROS. And here's the crucial part, the compensation works. Sarah survives. She keeps winning her court cases. She functions.
It works in the short term, but the biological bill comes due, which leads to stage three, cost accumulation.
This is the logic of allostatic load manifesting physically. The compensations Sarah's body made become physiologically and energetically exorbitant. Constantly bathing her tissues in cortisol and glucose causes microscopic wear and tear on the endothelial lining of her blood vessels. The chronic low-grade inflammation from her gut starts to damage healthy cells globally.
So she's rusting from the inside.
The mitochondrial stress produces excessive reactive oxygen species, leading to widespread oxidative damage to her proteins and DNA. The price of adaptation is beginning to erode her long-term viability. Sarah starts feeling the cost. She is exhausted all the time. Her joints ache. She has brain fog. Her blood pressure is creeping up, but she ignores it, grabs another coffee, and pushes through.
Which pushes her biology right to the edge. Stage four, attractor formation. The text uses the word attractor, drawing from complex systems theory. This is where the trap snaps shut. Explain how the loops form.
This is the critical turning point in chronic disease. At stage four, positive feedback loops begin to form. The compensatory pattern becomes self-reinforcing and takes on a life of its own. Let's trace the biology of an attractor. The chronic inflammation from Sarah's stress and gut dysbiosis starts interfering with her insulin receptors. Her cells become resistant to insulin, meaning blood sugar stays dangerously high in the bloodstream.
Okay, so she's developing insulin resistance.
Yes. To deal with the toxic high blood sugar, her body converts it to visceral fat, storing it around her organs. But visceral fat is not just inert blubber, it is a highly active endocrine organ. The visceral fat itself begins secreting more inflammatory cytokines, like IL-6. This new inflammation worsens the insulin resistance, which causes the body to store even more visceral fat, which secretes even more inflammation.
It's a closed loop.
It is a vicious closed loop. The body has established a new pathological set point. Sarah's organism is now actively pouring its autopoietic energy into maintaining the very loop that is harming her because her biology believes this loop is the only way to manage the chronic stress environment she is trapped in.
Wow. The body fiercely defends the disease because it thinks the disease is a survival strategy. And that leads to stage five, loss of congruence.
In stage five, this local regulatory solution, the insulin resistance and visceral fat loop, becomes globally maladaptive. The conserved pattern no longer serves the whole organism. It begins to destroy it. Sarah goes to the doctor and she officially receives a diagnosis. She has developed full-blown type 2 diabetes, hypertension, and perhaps an autoimmune thyroid condition.
So her whole system is crashing.
The flexibility of her biological system has narrowed drastically. Her nested closures are wildly out of sync. She is suffering deeply, and her viable options for interacting with the world, her physical energy, her mood, her cognitive sharpness, are severely limited.
And if nothing changes, she reaches stage six, disintegration or transformation.
This is the final tipping point. The system cannot sustain the incongruence. It either deteriorates and collapses, meaning progressive organ failure, vascular disease, and eventually premature death, or it is forced into a radical reorganization.
What does that reorganization look like?
A crisis occurs. Perhaps Sarah suffers a mild heart attack or a complete nervous breakdown. This massive perturbation finally shatters the pathological attractor loop. It forces her to completely change her environment, her career, her diet, and her relationships, allowing the organism to finally find a new, healthier, viable configuration. Or if she doesn't change, the system fails completely.
I want every person listening to this to reframe how they look at their own lingering ailments right now. Next time you're dealing with a chronic issue, whether it's stubborn weight that won't budge, relentless brain fog, digestive nightmares, or a formally diagnosed autoimmune condition, the clinical question isn't just the machine question. What broken part of me needs to be cut out or suppressed? The profound biological question you have to ask yourself is, what pattern is my body trying to conserve? Under what constraints? At what energetic cost? And what is it about my environment, my relationships, or my history that is convincing my biology that this costly compensation is my only option for survival?
It changes the entire paradigm of seeking health. If Sarah's high blood pressure is a stage four attractor formation born of chronic stress, sleep deprivation, and insulin resistance, simply giving her an antihypertensive pill to artificially force her blood vessels to dilate does not cure the disease.
It's just a band-aid.
It suppresses a signal. Now, that pill might be absolutely necessary to prevent her from having a stroke tomorrow, which is vital, but it leaves the underlying organism niche incongruence completely intact. The loop is still running in the background.
Which begs the ultimate question. Once we view disease not as a broken machine part, but as a living system stuck in a costly survival loop, how do we actually go about fixing it? Yeah. How do we unravel the loop without just chemically masking the symptoms? This brings us to section six, the art of congruent perturbation.
Dr. Salisley defines healing in this framework as the restoration, reorganization, or expansion of viable structural coupling. It is about bringing those nested closures, the mitochondria, the immune system, the emotional state, back into dynamic congruence so the organism can thrive in its niche.
But the paper is very careful.
Yeah.
And we need to be incredibly careful here, too, to state that this model does not reject modern biomedical intervention. We are not throwing away the hospital.
Absolutely not. As we just said with Sarah, if blood pressure is in stroke territory, antihypertensive medication is a life-saving perturbation. If you have a raging systemic bacterial infection, an IV antibiotic is a necessary perturbation to prevent your autopoiesis from collapsing entirely. Surgery, exogenous insulin for a type 1 diabetic, targeted immunotherapy, these are incredibly powerful, miraculous tools.
But the difference lies entirely in the goal and the context of the intervention.
Exactly. In the machine metaphor, the goal is blind control. You force the number on the lab test back into the normal range using a chemical, and the doctor declares victory, even if the patient still feels utterly exhausted and miserable.
Right, because the chart looks good.
In the living coherence metaphor, the goal is to use interventions to reduce constraint and restore biological rhythm so the autonomous organism can reorganize itself toward health. You aren't curing the body. You are providing the precise, temporary perturbations required for the body to cure itself.
And to describe this highly specific approach to intervention, the paper borrows a concept from classical Chinese Taoist philosophy, which I find so beautiful. The concept is wu wei.
Wu wei is often translated into English as non-forcing action or effortless action.
Okay, pause. I need to play devil's advocate here again because this translation can sound deeply concerning. If I have a loved one who is seriously ill, let's say they have a severe aggressive autoimmune flare-up, and a doctor tells me their medical philosophy is non-forcing action, and they're basically going to do nothing and let nature take its course, that sounds like therapeutic negligence. It sounds dangerous.
And that is the single most common and most dangerous misunderstanding of Wu-Wei. It is absolutely not passivity. It is not standing by and doing nothing while a system collapses. Dr. Sakil uses Wu-Wei to describe highly disciplined, profoundly attuned action. It is action that aligns with the living organization's natural dynamics rather than imposing rigid, blind control against it.
Can you give an example?
Think of a sailor navigating a massive sailboat through a severe storm. If a sailor wants to move the boat directly against gale force winds and they just turn on a massive gas guzzling outboard engine and try to force the boat straight through the teeth of the gale, that is forcing action. It requires immense wasteful energy. It causes massive structural wear and tear on the hull, and the mast will likely snap under the conflicting pressures.
The machine approach, forcing an outcome regardless of the environment.
Yes. But the sailor practicing Wu-Wei does not sit back and let the boat sink. They tack. They intensely study the environment. They use the kinetic energy of the wind, angling the sails precisely, working with the physics of the storm to move the boat forward in a zigzag pattern. It requires immense skill, constant hypervigilant attention, and active physical effort. But it is non-forcing because it respects the structure of the system it is operating within. It leverages the system's own energy to achieve the goal.
Attuned perturbation. You listen to the biological system, you understand its structure and its current constraints, and you offer a perturbation that helps it unlock its own path back to coherence.
In clinical medicine, practicing Wu-Wei means you might absolutely prescribe the antibiotic or the blood pressure pill to stabilize the crisis, but you don't stop there. You also relentlessly perturb the environment to support the patient's reorganization.
So you look at the whole picture.
You address their sleep hygiene. You provide nutritional building blocks. You facilitate relational safety and psychological care to bring their nervous system out of chronic fight or flight. You prioritize the restoration of their gut microbiome after the antibiotics wipe it out. You are actively dismantling the specific environmental and physiological conditions that created the disease attractor in the first place, thereby allowing the body's autopoiesis to naturally reclaim its vitality.
The paper actually lists out the implications of Wu-Wei across several different fields of human interaction, and it's fascinating how perfectly this biological principle scales up to society. We just explored what a Wu-Wei hospital looks like, supporting self-reorganization rather than just suppressing symptoms. Let's look at education. If we view a student as a machine, how do we teach them versus if we view them as an autopoietic unity?
Under the machine metaphor, education is simply information transfer. The student is an empty hard drive, and the teacher is the programmer. The teacher downloads data dates, facts, formulas into the student and tests them to ensure the download was successful. But under Maturana's biological framework, learning is defined as a structural change in the learner that allows for new viable action. Wu-Wei in education means the teacher recognizes they cannot force learning into the student. Instead, the teacher curates an environment. They provide targeted perturbations, complex problems, compelling narratives, hands-on experiences, in a way that naturally triggers a transformation in the student's own structural understanding.
This makes me think of experiential learning. It is the difference between forcing a kid to memorize the dates of the Civil War from a textbook, which they will forget immediately after the test, versus having them read a deeply personal primary source diary from a soldier of the same age or walking a battlefield.
Exactly.
One is a forced data download. The other is an attuned perturbation that actually changes the student's structural coupling with history. They feel it. They understand the human cost. The knowledge becomes part of their biology.
It transforms their domain of distinctions. They see the world differently.
What about parenting? This is a massive one.
The paper notes that under the machine framework, parenting often looks like manufacturing. You view the child as raw clay to be molded into a predetermined ideal of success. You force specific inputs, tutors, sports, rigid discipline, expecting a specific guaranteed output.
And that backfires.
Because a child is structurally determined. Forcing action upon them often results in profound allostatic load. The child adapts by developing severe anxiety, depression, or rebellious loops just to survive the pressure. Wu-Wei parenting recognizes that a child is accompanied, not manufactured.
Accompanied, I like that.
Your role is to provide the robust, unwavering safety, the deep love, and the necessary boundary setting that creates a secure niche. You provide the rich soil so that the child's own unique, autonomous structural determination can unfold and flourish in a healthy way. You are a gardener, not a carpenter.
And finally, governance and social structure. This feels incredibly relevant right now.
Governance based on the machine metaphor relies on rigid, centralized control. It treats citizens as cogs that must be managed. It relies on top-down enforcement, surveillance, and forcing compliance through punitive measures, often at the direct cost of the citizen's dignity and life capacity.
What's the alternative?
A governance model informed by living coherence and Wu Wei would look radically different. It would prioritize conserving the dignity, autonomy, and relational networks of its people. It would understand that a truly resilient, healthy society emerges organically from the vital coherence and safety of its individual members, not from suppressing their nature or keeping them in a state of allostatic threat.
I really want the listener to sit with this concept of Wu Wei across their whole life. Where are you currently forcing action? Are you pushing through absolute bone-deep exhaustion with excessive caffeine and pure, white-knuckled willpower, treating your own body like a recalcitrant machine that just needs to be whipped harder to produce output? Are you fighting your body's signals of pain, anxiety, or burnout with distractions instead of listening to what those signals are desperately trying to tell you about the environment you are in?
We all do it.
How might you practice attuned perturbation instead?
Oh.
How can you work with your biological grammar rather than constantly declaring war on it?
It represents a profound philosophical and biological shift, moving from a posture of domination and control to a posture of participation and relationship.
It really is a beautiful way to view life. Now, as we move into the final stretch of this deep dive, we absolutely must cover the outro of Dr. Zatieli's paper, because as elegant, holistic, and deeply resonant as this theory is, we have to keep our feet firmly planted on scientific ground. The author outlines some very strict limits and safeguards.
Yes, Dr. Zatieli is very explicit that we must avoid the trap of vague, unscientific holism. It is very easy in wellness spaces to just wave our hands and say, everything is connected, man, it's all energy, and abandon rigorous, mechanistic, biological science. We cannot do that.
What are the specific safeguards we need to keep in mind?
First, we cannot reduce the magnificent complexity of autopoiesis to just one single mechanism. We cannot read this paper and walk away saying, oh, I get it. Health is just about having perfect mitochondria, or it's all about fixing the microbiome, or it's all about lowering cortisol.
Yeah.
Those are just the observable domains, the specific closures through which the living organization operates. The whole organism is the unity. If we just obsess over mitochondria, we're essentially just replacing the old car engine metaphor with the slightly more complex microscopic engine metaphor.
We miss the forest for a very specific type of tree.
Exactly. The second safeguard is absolutely crucial. Disease should never be romanticized.
I'm glad you brought this up, because when we say disease is a survival strategy or a compensatory adaptation, it can almost sound like we are praising the disease.
It can easily be misinterpreted that way. People might hear this framework and start thinking that disease is somehow a beautiful, wise expression of the body's inner knowing, and we should just let it be.
Which is dangerous.
Very. That is not what the science says. Pathogens are lethal. Environmental toxins cause horrific, irreversible damage to tissue. Genetic mutations cause immense tragic suffering. The claim in this paper is not that disease is beneficial or good. The claim is that understanding the grammar of the disease, the historical pattern of structural coupling that trapped the body in that state, is essential for truly resolving it rather than just chemically silencing it.
And that leads to the final safeguard, which we touched on with the Wu Wei concept, but it bears repeating. Non-forcing action is never an excuse for therapeutic passivity.
If someone's biological system is in acute crisis, if they are in stage 6, disintegration, suffering a massive hemorrhage or a septic infection, you do not sit back, stroke your chin, and contemplate their autopoiesis. You intervene decisively, rapidly, and powerfully with every tool modern medicine has to offer. But you do so with the ultimate guiding goal of restoring their internal capacity to self-regulate, not just to condemn them to a lifetime of artificial symptom management.
Okay, let's try to synthesize this incredible sprawling journey we have been on for the last hour. We started with the deeply ingrained idea that we are biological machines, waiting for the environment or a physician to instruct us on how to work.
And we have systematically deconstructed that metaphor. We've moved to a scientifically grounded understanding that we are autonomous, structurally determined unities. We are bustling cities, constantly producing and remaking ourselves moment by moment.
We maintain our viability through dynamic, nested closures of living coherence. We saw how this coherence scales up from the way reactive oxygen species act as a cellular language, to the way our immune system and microbiome negotiate our relational identity, all the way to how our subjective emotions physically configure our capacity to act in a social world.
We explored how chronic disease is not just a random broken part, but a costly conserved pattern of drift, a brilliant but ultimately destructive survival loop that the body gets trapped in when facing unrelenting allostatic load.
And we learned that true healing is the art of congruent attuned perturbation. It is using wu-wei disciplined non-forcing action to change the constraints and supports of our environment, providing the exact conditions our bodies need to find their way back to a viable, thriving state of coherence.
It is a remarkable, deeply empowering biological framework that places the organism's autonomy at the center of health.
It changes everything. But before we sign off, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final, slightly provocative thought. Something to chew on that builds on Dr. Seeley's principles, but extrapolates them out into the reality of our modern world. We talked briefly about Maturana's concept of natural drift, the idea that evolutionary lineages conserve ways of living based on their systemic, structural coupling with their specific niche over millions of years.
Right.
Our human ancestors survived and evolved in a niche that demanded constant physical movement. It demanded deep, inextricable communal reliance. It provided exposure to diverse, robust natural microbiomes in the soil and food. It dictated circadian rhythms tied strictly to the rising and setting of the sun. And most importantly, it featured acute, short-term stress running from a predator rather than chronic, unending, low-grade psychological dread.
A completely different world.
If our health is completely, inextricably coupled to our environment, and if our biology is entirely determined by our structure's desperate attempt to maintain coherence with that environment, what happens when we construct a highly artificial, completely unprecedented niche? We now live in a digital, largely sedentary, hyper-processed, socially isolated, and chronically stressful environment. Are we currently, as a society, forcing a natural drift into a new way of living that our ancient biological closures simply cannot maintain?
Sobering question.
Are the skyrocketing, unprecedented rates of chronic disease, severe anxiety, and autoimmune disorders we see today not actually diseases in the traditional sense? Are they instead the catastrophic, visible allostatic load of an entire species trying desperately to structurally couple with a niche it was never built for? As you go about your week, I want you to look closely at your environment. Look at your desk, your smartphone, your daily schedule, the food in your pantry, and the quality of your relationships. And ask yourself, what kind of organism is this niche teaching my body to become? Because remember, the hospital x-ray machine might give you a clean, comforting, black and white picture of a broken bone. But your actual living, breathing, vibrant health is found out there in the muddy, beautiful, complex waters of how you interact with the world around you. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive today. Keep exploring. Keep questioning the paradigms you've been handed. And keep learning. We will see you next time.